The White Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Well, here we are on October 8th, 2012. It's already altogether dark here where I am. And this is the first time that has happened so far this year, this fall. And it's not a daylight savings time yet, so I don't know what it's going to be like when that starts. I'm not even sure when it starts, but it's got to be coming up pretty soon. I'm Carolyn Yeager. I'm live with you for the next 2 hours, despite the title of the program, which is the Heretics Hour. But at one point, it went to 2 hours, and I just didn't change the title because it was popular and people were used to it, so just left it alone. My program tonight is a continuation of last week's Heretics Hour. It's patriarchy and homosexuality, although I'm kind of moving toward women's rights and growing white families tonight instead of exactly about patriarchy. But it, you know, it's part of that. And I would say in white nationalism today, and I'm going to begin again with the circumcision issue or question. And you see, the longer I look into these subjects, the more I discover. I'm seeing that they tie together quite a bit. For those who want to bury their heads in the sand, they might think I'm going too far or I'm, putting too much time into this, but I don't think so, and that's why I'm continuing with it. First, I want to say that my email is still trying to connect. I've gotten to it, but I haven't gotten into it. It's been extremely slow today, and I've been trying to get some attention on it, but I haven't succeeded in that. So I think I will make this little short announcement today that I am looking for a new administrator for my website, carolynyeager.net or .com. It seems that the present administrator has lost interest in it, or is too busy otherwise, and doesn't communicate. So I know that I need to make some changes, but it's been difficult to come to this decision. I need to also move to another server, but I want to make sure that my website is working right before I do that. And so, my website uses Drupal. I don't want to say too much about this, but it uses Drupal, and I don't want to change that because it works very well for what I, I don't know. Maybe it could be changed, but it seems like it'd be an awful lot of trouble. But if there's anyone out there who is really good, I want somebody who's really good, who really understands and is on a high level of technical knowledge about computers and computer programming and so on. Of course, I would pay the person, but, it's hard to let somebody you don't know take over your website at this point with all, I'm quite suspicious of so many people, now. So, I would have to get to know the person. Well, I'm just putting this out there because I don't know any other way to do it. So if anybody really has a good solution here or really knows someone, and if there's anyone who is who fits the bill and is willing to take on another account, let me know. That would be at carolyn@carolynyeager.com. I will get into that eventually, but so far I haven't. So I'm still working from the website CircLeaks. And that is www.circleaks.org. And the connection that I'm making is between being pro-circumcision and being homosexual. You know, I started out with Jewish people. I started out noting how many Jews were in this, and the reason we all understand the reason why Jews are so interested in circumcision. But as I look at some of these people that I decided to talk about tonight, I came to the conclusion that they're probably almost all, homosexual. So I'm going to tell you, give you my reasons for this, and I'm going to talk about this quite a bit because I think this has, I've got plans to talk about pedophilia in the future and pedophilia in high places and the connections there, which I think is where if we really want to get somewhere in our white movement, we have to look at all these things and we have to clean this up somehow because it's this whole sex thing. You know, I read today, I'm going to be talking about that later, Lash of Dark Moon's part two of her two-part article on pornography over at the Occidental Observer. And I looked through the comments. There was a lot of them, but I went through them real fast. Excuse me. There's a lot of basis for what she says, but there's a lot of denial of those who don't want to look at it and don't want to believe it and don't even want to think about it. So this is all something that I think somebody needs to go into, and I think she's done a good job in doing it. If she is a she, there are people who say she's not a woman. That's a man taking on that name of Lash of Dark Moon and so on. I've had some correspondence with her, and I kind of think she's a woman. I think she is kind of who she says she is, but one doesn't know because we are surrounded on the internet with people not using their real names, but most of the people are pretty honest about who they are, even if they don't use, or you know, you can kind of tell if people are coming from a real place or not. But you know, we've been fooled by a lot of people, so one is always has to take everything with that in mind. Anyway, what I want to start out with now in this talking about circumcision in the first part of the show is Brian J. Morris. I mentioned Brian J. Morris last week in connection with Jake Waskett and Vernon Quaintance, but I didn't say too much about Mr. Morris. So I'm going to start with him tonight, and that's where I got the idea that there was something very strange about him. And I tried to, you know, the word that would come to my mind was evil. There's a picture of him there. He's on that page with all the names on it. You'll find his name there. You can, if you go to that site, you can click on it and you can, I'm still trying to get into my email, and I'm looking at it, but it just won't stop spinning around. It'll eventually get there, I guess. And I'll see if there's any messages from my listeners. Brian Morris, yeah, he thought the word evil came to mind, but I don't like that word. I don't like using evil, and I don't like I've used that myself when I can't come up with something else soon enough, and so I just say evil, and then I'm sorry I did, and because what is evil? And we throw that word around so much now. Everywhere you look, we talk, people are talking about evil this and evil that, and of course, evil is a very strong word, so I try to think of another word. It took me a while, actually. I came up with quite a few that I rejected, and then finally I came up with twisted. Twisted. And I thought, that's it. That would fit. This Brian J. Morris just looks like he's kind of twisted. And when you read about him, he's just kind of the worst. He's one of the worst that you come up with there. He is truly out to make the world a place where every male child is circumcised at birth. I mean, all over the world. He is so aggressive about it. He's so determined about it, and he works very hard at it. And he's associated with this Jake Waskett quite a bit, and along with Vernon Quaintance. Now, just it's hard to kind of start with these people because there's so many, so many ties and so many, well, I'm getting tongue-tied tonight. So many leads that go from one place to another. But what we find with him is that he is, just to start out, he sounds, you know, he sounds just fine. He's, well, you know what I did? I didn't write his stuff down. I guess I was going to go to that page and talk about him, except I should. Nope. Yep. So I have to go over there. And Brian, but he's a professor at the University of Sydney in Australia. Sorry about this, folks. I don't know why I'm so confused at the moment. He's a professor at of molecular biology and so on, at the University of Sydney. He's not a doctor. He's not, well, he's kind of a researcher. He's a researcher that works at the university in that department of physiology. And, he's an avid circumcision advocate. And he's the most vocal Australian circumcision promoter there is in Australia. And he had to be kind of restrained by his university because he was using their name and their things connected with university for his circumcision promotion. And they told him to stop doing that, but they don't stop him from doing it. So, but he's also a member of the Gilgal Society, and he was and of the Circlus Society, which I talked about last week. And even the Acorn Society. I mean, he's in on all of them. And he's in regular contact with this Jake Waskett. And Jake Waskett is the one I told you is edits the Wikipedia pages. He's a computer. I should get him to run my... He's the kind of person I would need because he's so, supposed to be such a whiz at computers. And he is... that's part of his interest. His other... interest is in circumcision, and he has, as I told you, he has edited over 1,000 Wikipedia pages, but they're not all about circumcision because he's also does his he's got some technical issues that he's interested in. I guess he's pretty smart, but he has edited every page on Wikipedia that has any connection at all with circumcision and, to make it more pro circumcision. And, you know, the people at Wikipedia know that. It's all there, I guess, in their records. And this man is also said by CircLeaks straight out that he is a homosexual. He's the only one that they say is a homosexual. They give a source, but I couldn't tell from the source really why it showed that he was a homosexual. But there's some things I don't understand. But anyway, if CircLeaks comes right out, they're very careful, very careful. And if they come right out and say that he is a homosexual, I'm going to accept that. And the reason that I started to think that Brian Morris was homosexual is because of partly as I looked at him, and thought, well, what is it about him? If he's not Jewish, why did he get so carried away with this? And then I looked at him. I thought, well, gee, he's probably a homosexual. And I started looking for any information about him having a family or children. Not that they actually put that in there, but you might find it somewhere. Well, he's got a website, a pretty big website. He's written tons of articles promoting circumcision, along with some other of his scientific stuff that he's supposed to be doing, and he has puts out lots of pamphlets for families and parents and mothers and so on, and even teenagers about circumcision, which are supposed to give neutral information for them to make a consideration about it, but are actually biased towards it. I've got some examples of this. And he's written some of these articles with, in collaboration with this Jake Waskett. Like, there's two of them I have here. Well, there's three. One is, Morris, B.J. Morris, another guy, Jake Waskett, this Thomas Wiswell, which I will talk about a little bit in a minute, and D.T. Halperin, Donald Halperin, called Medicaid Coverage of Newborn Circumcision, a Health Parity Right of the Poor, which is published in American Public Health Journal. And then he's collaborated on one of these pamphlets for the Gilgal Society with Vernon Quaintance and Jake Waskett, and then Brian Morris's name is there. They wrote a pamphlet, Sex and Circumcision, What Every Woman Needs to Know. And then there's another one with Jake Waskett and Brian Morris, titled Fine Touch Pressure Thresholds in the Adult Penis, which was in another BJU, some university journal, I guess, in 2007. So we know that Waskett is a homosexual, and to say a little more about him, well, I probably have this here somewhere, but I moved it on down or something, so I'll go back. Now, let me finish here about... Okay, you know, I mentioned to you last week that this Vernon Quaintance, who created the Gilgal Society, and I told you what it was, and what the name stands for and everything, and that he was arrested about a month or so ago for owning child pornography of some of the worst kind of very, very young children. And he's out on bail, but he probably won't get sent to prison for it. His lawyer's working up a pretty good case for him. But at this time, Brian Morris removed the Gilgal Society and all references to Vernon Quaintance from his website, which is called circinfo.com or .org. I'm not sure. Circinfo. That's his website, and it's a very large website. I guess I could go to it. I don't want to spend time moving around the computer too much, moving around on the internet too much. But on his website, which I don't exactly have here right at the moment, he has all kinds of articles. I've got some of them copied down here. I guess I've got it down here. I thought I would talk about all these guys, then I would come on. Here's his stuff. All right. He writes on his website that he's a researcher with the University of Sydney in the physiology department. He says, I am not Jewish, nor a medical practitioner or lawyer, so have no religious bias or medical legal concerns that might get in the way of a rational presentation of the information that has been published in reputable journals. I have no involvement in clinical medicine. So, you know, he's trying to tell people that he doesn't have any reason to be biased, but yet he is so totally pro-circumcision. He says it's based on all the studies and research he has done, which shows that a circumcised male has such health benefits over being uncircumcised. On his website, he has an article, Why Are Human Males Born with the Foreskin? And he says in there, the foreskin has no role after birth. I mean, he puts that as a flat statement. He says a lot of strange things, truthfully. He says there's no good evidence of any adverse effect of lack of a foreskin. Well, that is very much disputed by many people, including medical people and people in science and so on. So, you know, but he makes these statements because he thinks that he'll be believed. He has a theory. He says one might speculate that the foreskin in primitive humans or prehumans could have protected the head of the penis from long grass, shrubbery, etc., when our primitive ancestors wore no clothes. Well, that seems like a logical speculation on first glance, but really, how long ago was that? And why would that thing still be there? And why does it have such a good purpose, if it has, as he says, no role anymore after birth? It's something that is, primitive and that we don't need anymore. That's what they said about tonsils. I had my tonsils yanked out when I was 7 years old based on that idea that tonsils were something left over that we didn't need anymore. It turned out to be totally false. That was finally shown to be false. And that was just a fashionable idea at the time, pushed by, I guess, doctors who wanted to make that money taking out kids' tonsils. It's not a very big deal when you're young, but I certainly missed it. I had got strep throat 3 times in my teens and in early 20s, so it plays a big role in fighting infection and so on. And also, well, anyway, I won't go into that. But he says another speculation he puts forth is that the foreskin might have helped that keeping the tip of the penis moist, which would facilitate quicker penetration of a female. Because as in those times, you know, they had so much dangers around that lengthy foreplay would have been a survival disadvantage. So, they needed this, lubrication for the tip of their penis, but, now it's not needed for whatever reason, we can engage in sexual intercourse at leisure. Well, this is just crazy talk, you know, for a scientific person to say something like that. And another possibility, he says, comes up. He keeps coming up with more reasons that someone else came up with, but that he agrees with, is that maybe the foreskin could, in fact, be the male equivalent of the hymen in a woman. It may have served as an impediment to sexual intercourse in adolescent primeval humans before the advent of our species of civilization and cultures. This would go way back. And he says that way back then, the foreskin would have reduced successful sexual acts in those too young to adequately care for any offspring that might arise. Well, I'm no scientist, but this seems like a cultural thing. And would the body grow something to stop young people from having sex when that's really a cultural idea rather than a physical, you know, part of your physiology? So, he's saying that society introduced circumcision to free the individual from the impediment of having a foreskin. And he even says that other interesting facts are that that the word for uncircumcised in Hebrew means obstruction or to impede. So explaining the biblical term uncircumcised heart, referring to obstructionism. Things like that is what he comes up with. Then he has another part of his on his website that I read. Why medical bodies and others should not advise that circumcision should be delayed until the boy can make the decision for himself. And his reasons are things like circumcision protects infant circumcision. That's what he's after. That's what these people are after. Natal, you know, infant circumcision right after birth. It's protection against UTIs and kidney damage in infancy. Well, how many infants get this? You know, I mean, this is not anything common, but they use this to scare parents who aren't very smart that all this stuff can happen to their baby if they don't circumcise him. The second one, freedom from phimosis and balanitis in childhood and at puberty is lost. Well, this is also very uncommon, you know, and I've read that phimosis was way over diagnosed in little boys just because of lazy doctors and because they don't if they see something and they just say, well, it must be that, and they order a circumcision, because that's the easiest thing to do. When it isn't phimosis at all, and there's a lot of literature on that, which I don't have time to go into. But then they say that if you wait to circumcise a boy until he's of an age to give his consent, then he may already have become sexually active. And that means that the benefits of circumcision would not be there for him. You see, now, is this not a meaningless reason? This is the kind of thinking. I'm saying these things because I want to convey the kind of reasons, the kind of talk, the kind of proofs and so on, medical ideas that these people who are funded by the National Associations of Health and funded by the Gates, Foundation and so on, and funded and have these high positions, this is the kind of things they come up with to justify their desire to circumcise infants. If you wait until they can give their consent, well, they may have already got something, which would have been prevented if they had been circumcised at birth. You see how, see the kind of reasoning that is? Then he says, in the same vein, the risk of complications is higher for later circumcisions. Well, sure, you shouldn't have it to begin with, but if you wait until the boy is in his teens, there can be more complications than if you do it when they're an infant, although there have been complications and even deaths of infants because of circumcision. And then he says it costs more to do it when they're older. He says there's not enough educational resources around for boys to make an informed decision. That's a totally non-argument. He says if there are a lot of adolescents getting circumcised because they waited until they decided on it themselves, it would strain medical resources. That's another non-argument. Boys who choose circumcision will certainly wish it had been done in infancy. Another non-argument. Okay, how many would choose it? If some choose it, well, they might say, well, I wish it had been done then. But they didn't. But now a lot of boys would choose not to, you see. So, again, all these are non-arguments. He's got a couple more. Here, the last one. Major international and American health and medical organizations are now urging circumcision, especially in infancy. Now, that's a false statement because they're not urging it. Some are recommending it, some are not, and some are sort of neutral on it. But to say that the major, he might have one or two he can point to, internationally too. There's a big difference between international and American and other European countries and so on. So he's just lying. Another interesting thing I'll just bring up now, because I won't fit it in later, is this idea of smegma, because this is on his website. And so, you know, they always talk about the smegma that accumulates on an uncircumcised penis. And, you know, so I thought, boy, this is a weird word, because it sort of makes you think of smelly, you know, smelly smegma. I mean, it just looks like smelly, a word. And so I looked it up to be sure I knew what it was. And, you know, it is some stuff that accumulates on the gland to keep the glands moist of the penis, you know, the tip of the penis moist, and facilitates sexual intercourse by acting as a lubricant. A couple of doctors wrote an article saying in 2006, saying called The Carcinogenity of Smegma, Debunking a Myth. What they were doing was that these circumcisers had been putting out these stories that smegma was carcinogenic. You know, it was dangerous and it was a bad thing to have. And if you were circumcised, you wouldn't have so much of it. And you know, but they debunked that. They debunked that. And it was in a European Journal of Dermatology. And then another one, these same two doctors wrote Immunological Functions of the Human Prepuce, Sexually Transmitted Infections. Well, they were they were also debunking something that that this I keep wanting to call him Bailey. What's his darn name? Gosh. How can I? Brian Morris. It's Brian Morris, not Bailey. Well, there's a bunch of things here. Anyway, the facts are, okay, then later, here's the thing. Later, Jake Waskett and Brian Morris wrote an article debunking these doctors, or trying to. Their article was The Carcinogenity of Smegma Debunking a Myth. That was the title of theirs. And they said then an example of myth and myth chif making. And they tried to show that these doctors were wrong in their article. Now, the facts about smegma are that newly produced smegma has a smooth, moist texture. It is thought to be rich in squalene and contains prostatic and seminal secretions, desquamated epithelial cells, and the mucin content of the urethral glands of something of litrate. Some state that it contains antibacterial enzymes such as lysozyme and hormones such as androsterone. Now, this is in Wikipedia, and it's these doctors who are the source of this. And then it adds, though others dispute this. And when you look at the source of who these others are, guess what? It's Morris and Waskett in this one article here that they wrote about an example of myth and myth chif. So this is no doubt Jake Waskett, the computer whiz, who is the editor of Wikipedia pages, who added that and put that in there, and it has stayed there, that this truth about smegma has been disputed. And see if I have this other statement down here. Yes. Now, it's also been said that in healthy animals, smegma helps clean and lubricate the genitals. This is actually in animals, you know, cows and horses and dogs and cats or whatever the heck. You know, that it's... that it's important. But now Brian Morris says this about it. The bacteria alone gives off an offensive smell, and most people consider smegma to be unclean. See, he's wrong. He's lying again. This is really not true. He says men differ in their sensitivity to this smell, and some shower several times a day as a result. See my section on what men say. Some uncircumcised men and or their partners find the stench so unpleasant that the foul odor has caused these men to seek a circumcision on this basis alone. Improved penile hygiene is perhaps the major reason for circumcision. That is, he says, 82%, one study showed that 82% of men who got circumcisions was to improve their penile hygiene. And for most, smegma is regarded as unclean and infected with microorganisms. See, now, this is false, and he's trying to convince men that women won't like him if he's not circumcised. That's what he's trying to do. He doesn't care that he says things that aren't true or that others in the medical, in the research field dispute and say is wrong. He just puts that in there anyway. It says on this Wikipedia page about smegma, on several occasions, Morris has called those against circumcision foreskin fetishists. He sometimes cites a paper written in 1965 called Foreskin Fetishism and Its Relation to Ego Pathology in a Male Homosexual, which links to Jake H. Waskett's website. Waskett has a website too. Here's the thing that, Brian Morris writes this: a subgroup of the gay community practice docking, a sexual practice that requires the foreskin. Naturally, such men would want to ensure that an adequate supply of boys with foreskins are coming up through the ranks, where a proportion will have an orientation towards males. Why don't those who wish to outlaw male circumcision be honest enough to admit the real reason for their campaign? And by the way, docking is regarded on gay health websites as unsafe sex, as it exposes the vulnerable mucosal inner lining of the foreskin to infection by HIV, to name just some of the medical hazards posed by the foreskin. But I think it's very possible, since Waskett is a homosexual and goes along, he does this in conjunction with Waskett, that he is trying to put across that the gay community does not want circumcision, that the gay community prefers uncircumcised penises, and therefore he's not gay, and it's not gays who want to circumcise. But the fact is that I think that homosexuals do like uncircumcised penises, but I can't say for sure. But you know, I went back and looked at those paintings by my old fellow student in art school, Hilton Brown, and I looked at all those paintings that he did of men with their, you know, with the penis front and center, and then of just the penis and so on. He was, you know, fat. He was fixated on painting men's penises and the men, but sometimes with their heads cut off, you know, heads not a part of the painting. Anyway, I mean, there's a whole slew of them, and most of them, it looks like the men are circumcised. It looks like the men are circumcised. But since things happened during, it's kind of hard to tell. There are a few of them that look like it might be that there was a foreskin there. Because, of course, all these men that he painted, and he probably painted men that he knew, he had models, they wouldn't have all been circumcised. But anyway, you know, I'm really not speaking as an expert here, but I think that's the feeling I got, that this Morris has taken this thing about homosexuals and docking and so on and turned it around to make it seem different than it is, and that he actually is a part of the gay community and that he likes circumcised penises, because in these societies that they have these discussion groups, Gilgal and the Circlist and Acorns Club and so on, Cutting Club, they all admire the circumcised penis. They talk on and on about how good looking it is and how they hate that foreskin and so on. And they, you know, it's all about looks. It's all about aesthetics and so on for them, in a certain kind of way they want to be, which is very common with homosexuals who are very much into aesthetics and, of course, very much focused on that part of their body, much more than normal men are. Normal men, of course, care about that part of their body, but they're not all fascinated with it like homosexuals are. So I'm going to go on now to these other men. And after Brian Morris and Jake Waskett, there is Robert Bailey and Stephen Moses. Well, Robert Bailey is another one who is, he just looks like a homosexual to me, because he's trim and fit looking. He's not old. I mean, he's not young, but he looks kind of, well, he looks like he could have had a facelift or something, because he looks like he's older, but he's still got a kind of a young look, and he's got a good haircut and all that. And he, there's also, again, he lives in Chicago. He teaches at the, teaches at the University of Illinois campus, all about HIV, AIDS, and circumcision and so on. That's his field. These two men did an RCT together in Kenya, Africa. I told you about that last week. In their trial, the circumcised group had specific instructions to abstain from sex and use condoms that the intact control group did not. See, so they cheated in that. This group that they circumcised, they were told to not have sex and to use condoms, but the intact control group was not given those rules, probably because these circumcised ones had just had their circumcision. And so this was a part of during their healing. But then the others would have been having sex, you know, because they were not circumcised and they could have the usual. Remember, these are Africans, who are very high, a high risk population because of all the sex, unprotected sex they have. And yet, he admitted that, they still needed repeated visits and intensive behavioral counseling, these circumcised men, to reduce the risk to them. But even in that case, not this particular group, but some other groups had, that were tested, found that the circumcised, men had, less HIV/AIDS than the, had more HIV/AIDS than the uncircumcised. So none of these tests have been really conclusive, but they pretend that they have been. Now, you know, I have to go back to these men's pages, but Brian, let me see, I do it this way. Robert Bailey, yeah, he's kind of a good looking guy, but I don't like his looks, but he's got a, well, I just think he's a homosexual. And none of these people, do they ever say anything about a family? And then they're off there in Africa. He spends a lot of time in Africa, this guy, Bailey, trying to get Africans to be circumcised. He's got this real passion. These people all have this passion for doing it. He's been a circumcision proponent since 1998, Bailey. And the fellow that he's associated with, Stephen Moses, is Jewish. Let me find him here. But, he looks like he could be a nice family man. But then again, I was looking at him, and he's a very Jewish-looking guy. Doesn't look at all like, he doesn't have that look like Steve, like Robert Bailey, that he's so well kept. But he's got this kind of a look, and now I look and I say, gee, you know, he looks like a homosexual too. And now maybe you think I'm crazy that I'm just seeing that everywhere, but there are certain ways that people look that fit that, and other ways which don't, and these people all fit it. So what they say about him is that he's been an advocate of circumcision since 1994. Well, you can say that that's a part of his, just because he's Jewish. They don't even say he's Jewish, but he is Jewish. But here his associates, his colleagues and associates are Brian Morris, Robert Bailey, this Edgar Schoen and Daniel Halperin, I'm going to talk about next, and Maria Wauer. So, and he's also associates with the Gilgal Society and the Circlist. Well, if you write and comment and read and, you know, participate in those societies, you are either a circumcision fanatic or fetishist, and very likely homosexual, because you just get turned on, or you might not be homosexual, but you get turned on sexually by watching circumcisions, talking about circumcisions, and so on. So the next couple that I'm going to talk about is, here's something that I'm not done with Robert Bailey. Robert Bailey has said, this is a quote from him, talking about the Africa. I know foreskin is not pretty, but these slides are pretty. So he thinks that foreskins are not pretty. You know, these are people who really want to get rid of that foreskin. They don't like it. Bailey has also said about being in Africa, we're hacking away at it every month. Those foreskins are flying. So, he's anxious to get rid of as many of them as he can. Now, the next two are Daniel Halperin and Edgar Schoen. Daniel Halperin is Jewish. His father was a Jew born in Russia and a Mohel. But Daniel Halperin absolutely appears to be unmarried and childless. And at one point he said, you know, if I ever have a son, which probably he's not ever going to have a son. So I think the same of him and this Edgar Schirn. I thought he was when I looked at him, and he lives in San Francisco. He looks Jewish and he looks gay. Now he's an older guy with white hair, but a big smile on his face, wears a bow tie. And, he worked for Kaiser Permanente in Oakland for 24 years. He still has his office, on their campus in San Francisco. And, it's in the Julia Morgan building in genetics department in San Francisco. And it's only a few yards from the home office of Daniel Halperin, his partner in Africa, who, is assistant professor of anthropology at University of California, San Francisco's Center for AIDS. So both these men live in San Francisco. They're unmarried. They're both Jewish. And they did one of these RCT studies. And, Schirn was also head of that, task force that the American Academy of Pediatrics, had going on, and just came out recently with their conclusion that they're kind of neutral on it, but they would be swayed a little bit towards circumcision, but it was really up to the parents. He was trying to get him to say it differently. He was trying to get him to come out and recommend circumcision, but there are other people on that task force who didn't want to do it, so it didn't pass. But he is quoted as saying that circumcision, it's like apple pie. It's part of being American. And he said other things similar to that, where it's just the American way and stuff like that, you know. Now this Halperin, though his father was a Jew, he has denied that his being Jewish has any bearing on his pro-circumcision stand. And he said that he believes circumcision will go further than any other intervention available in stopping the HIV, and that circumcision will prevent HIV among homosexual men. So they're concerned about homosexuals, all of them. They say things about homosexuals. Well, of course, because they're into HIV/AIDS, and that affects homosexuals quite a bit because of their wild, unprotected sex, which I will talk a little bit about in the second half. But they just believe that this, they say that this is going to, this is the best thing going, circumcision, to prevent all kinds of diseases, but especially AIDS, which is somehow being transported all over the world by these, why? Because Africans are moving all over the world, probably. These Africans are coming into all kinds of white countries and bringing all their stuff with them. I don't know. And they're not going to stop that. They don't want to stop that. They just want to circumcise everyone. Now I've got, my idea is that these six that are part of this list of people, are all very suspicious, and that there is this connection between being so pro-circumcision and being Jewish and being homosexual. There's a very good article that I wanted to, here's one little thing about Brian Morris. You know, Brian Morris is quoted here, by saying, where did he say that? That it was, that about a fetish of, oh yeah, well he called it a foreskin fetish. He was calling these, Oh, yeah, here it is. He was calling those who are against circumcision foreskin fetishists. And he's used that term several times. And the Circleaks people just made the point that a fetish is any object or non-genital part of the body that causes a habitual erotic response or fixation. We'd say people have foot fetishes, you know, that they get sexually aroused by rubbing or handling or looking at somebody's feet. And that is true. Or you might have an ear fetish or any kind of fetishes, but not a fetish to do with genitals, because then it's not a fetish, you see. But he is saying that he is using it incorrectly as a foreskin fetish. Well, let me see here. Circumcision in Britain has some really good points that I can make in my last 8 or 9 minutes here. This writer is comparing circumcision in Britain with the United States, and saying that the people in the United States are just irresponsible and are crazy with circumcision. But he says that there's too many in Britain too. This was written in 1999. But he said that there were 60,000 circumcisions each year in Britain, almost all without any legitimate medical justification, and one half for purely ritual reasons. He divides up between those for ritual reasons, which he doesn't approve of either, this writer, and the others for medical reasons, which are also not justified. He says that 1% or fewer of those that are performed for medical reasons are performed for no reason whatsoever, because there's nothing wrong with the person's they say that they have this thing called phimosis that they use for any kind of little problem that there might be, but it turns out that it's not really phimosis, and that this whatever it is can be cured and can go away. It's just temporary, but they recommend these doctors, he says, out of idleness, ease, ignorance of the anatomy, function, and value of the foreskin. They're ignorant of what it's good for. They're ignorant of the literature and so on. So they just refer them for amputation. Well, that's the same thing they did when they're taking out tonsils. They were ignorant of the benefits of tonsils and why they were there and what they were doing. And they decided that they were just something left over. I already said that. And they could just take them out, and that would solve the problem. So if there's any problem, well, you just remove it. We're familiar with that in a lot of other things that they want to remove from people. he's just given the four types there. And talking about these, that there's no reason for these routine circumcisions based on phimosis. And, he just makes the point that the British medical profession's failure to examine the physical, psychological, and sexological consequences of circumcision may stem from unjustified fears of breaching codes of religious tolerance, fears of provoking the politically dangerous charges of anti-Semitism, and so on. And that's absolutely true. We need to keep that in mind. And the failure of the medical profession... faults the failure of the medical profession to examine circumcision objectively, and that may stem from personal motivations such as pre-existing biases of religious, psychosexual, or financial origin. Well, of course, there's the talk of how much money these doctors make removing foreskins, because they get, you know, a few hundred dollars every time they do it, and if they do a lot of them, that really adds up to a lot of money. So the financial reasons are not minor. So there's the religiously motivated view. And then there's also the media. Here is a good sentence. It says that the advice, he says, the in Britain, the advice invariably given by advice columnists and agony aunts, in quotes, in the British popular press and on television, that circumcision is a minor procedure causing no harm or loss. You see, here we see the Jewish media at work. They're helping to push this idea that it's just a nothing thing. Just go ahead and do it. And, you know, it has health benefits for your child. And he doesn't lose anything that he needs to have. And who are some of the doctors? He says there's a lot of discredited people who used to push this. He mentions that in the United States, such extremists were doctors J.M. Moses, Abraham L. Wolbarst, and Abraham Ravitch in the 19th and 20th centuries. And in the currently, doctors Edgar J. Schoen, who I mentioned, and Gerald N. Weiss, another one who I don't know about. These are all these five men are Jews. These were all some of the biggest promoters of circumcision. And they're joined by some Gentile doctors, the most vocal of whom is Dr. Thomas E. Wiswell, who is also on this list, whose name is also on this page at CircLeaks. And that is about all that I can say about this today. But I want to reiterate that it's not just, you know, you have to look at people who are really seriously pushing this and how others just go along with it rather than resist it, and how little there is any oversight in the medical or any other part of our okay, see ya.
Es ist einer dieser Tage, an die wir bei Oma sind. Es duftet nach Kuchen und Kaffee. Wir lauschen ihren Worten, ihre Tränen sind nicht zu übersehen. Wenn sie von Oma erzählt, sie alle gingen damals einen schweren Gang, und ich schaue auf die Bilder an Omas Wand. Opa, ich vermisse dich, und ich glaube fest daran, egal was man auch erzählt, du warst ein guter Mann. Die Oma sagt, du warst ein Held und gabst dein Leben für das Land. Ihre Tränen lügen nicht, und zu gern hätte ich dich gekannt. Erzählt von einer Zeit, für uns unvorstellbar, geprägt von Tränen, Glück und Leid. Und immer wenn sie Opa sah, klingt ihre Stimme seicht und warm. Sie schließt ihre Augen und sie fällt schlafen in meinen Arm. Sie alle gingen damals einen schweren Gang, und ich schaue auf die Bilder an Omas Wand. Opa, ich vermisse dich, und ich glaube fest daran, egal was man auch erzählt, du warst ein guter Mann. Die Oma sagt, du warst ein Held und gab sein Leben für das Land. Ihre Tränen lügen nicht und zu gern hätte ich dich gekannt. Opa, ich vermisse dich und ich glaube fest daran, egal was man auch erzählt, du warst ein guter Mann. Die Oma sagt, du warst ein Held und gab sein Leben für das Land. Ihre Tränen lügen nicht und zu gern hätte ich dich gekannt.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is the Heretics Hour. I am Carolyn Yeager, and it is October 8th, 2012. And I was talking about circumcision, and I had just gotten to the part, which I'm going to continue with here, because it has to do with the next subject, which is kind of connected. And that is that the desire to mutilate the genitals of others has a deep sexual motive. This is the conclusion of this writer on this article about the British article. This motive combined with the urge to control people, when in the 19th century, you know, it was first medicalized, circumcision was first medicalized in a vain attempt to prevent masturbation. I like the idea of the desire to control people and the deep sexual motive. That's why I tied in with these men's sexual proclivities and their sexual fascinations, and this is pornography. And I mentioned, I believe I mentioned Lash of Dark Moon's article at the beginning. And I think it's a valuable article. This sexual attraction to circumcision, these men masturbate while they watch these others being circumcised. It's their pornography. It's their sexual turn on. And I guess it must become addictive, as Dark Moon's article, I think very correctly, puts forth, that it is so addictive. That's why these people stay in it. They get stronger and stronger until it's kind of obvious that they're overboard with it, but they can't stop it. They can't help it. And they use their academic credentials to protect themselves. And these universities and places where they work, some of them are actually collaborative anyway in these things, like the University of California, Kaiser Permanente, and this university in Sydney, probably. They're all on this liberal agenda. So they don't mind what these people are doing. And and homosexuality, as we know today, is the in thing to be. I mean, you know, back in the 70s and 80s, you know, if you were black, you got preferential treatment. And then if you were Latino, you got preferential treatment. You know, if you were a woman of any race, you got preferential treatment. And now homosexuals are the key people who are getting preferential treatment. I mean, in that world, if you, homosexuality is just great, you know, it's just embraced. And of course, I really do believe personally, my personal belief is that our president, Barack Obama, is homosexual. So much points to it. And these things are not really, you know, you don't see anything that's showing you otherwise just because he's got a wife and a couple of kids. It's the thing to be. It's the thing to be, and it's being forced on us. And so, but this idea of sex and power and politics and, that's enough right there is very strong, and it's all connected. And I guess, this is part of what we have to blast through. We have to get rid of it. We have to see it for what it is. We can't tolerate it, and we have to clean it up, and we certainly have to clean it up in our movement, I think. So from that, I will move on then to taking advantage of the helpless, taking advantage of children. That's what pedophilia is. You know, the innocence and circumcision of infants. How is it different? Some countries they do it to girls. Sometimes they do it to girls when they're infants too. I thought maybe the girls had to grow up a little bit, or that whatever what they wanted to remove wasn't really there or something, but I guess not, because I've read of female infant circumcision too. But usually they do it also, the Muslims, they also do it with the boys when they're older. So it's tribal and it's a religious ritual, but it's also a deep inner kind of power to control those who you can control. And we can all control little kids. Also in religion, there is that element. I'm sorry to say, but it is there, of the priests and the elites to have control not only of the women. We see how religions have controlled women, have made their laws and their rules and so on to control the women. But they also want to control the men. The Jews, whoever they were back then, wanted the Moses types and so on, and wanted to control their men. So they came up with this circumcision thing, or it may have just kind of come up on its own. But anyway, there it was, and they used this circumcision to force all men to this kind of atrocity on themselves, and to mark them as part of their tribe under their control. And that also did something to the men, if you weren't one of the elite men. And we know now how we have this elite power group. I mean, this is not a joke. This is not something made up. This is not a fairy tale. It's all very real. So, I'm going to talk some about, what really is more like, what is women's role in white nationalism, and what are women's rights, and should women have any, and all of that, and tie it in with these other subjects. And I'm bringing up Matt Parrott again. Not that I intended to, but today I read, I went to Countercurrents website, and there was something, there was this article about Merlin Miller blaming Merlin Miller for the things that he did, which I agree with. You know, I talked about Merlin Miller, brought that up. I might have brought it up last Monday, but I brought it up two Saturdays ago, and last Saturday again, I think. I'm not sure. But anyway, I've talked about it, and how he kind of trashed white nationalists and said they didn't want them in the A3P. Things like that. And so, then, a lot of the a lot of the commenters to that article on Countercurrents, and it's a fairly new article, said it was wrong to criticize Merlin Miller, and we should never criticize one another, and we must all stand together in solidarity, and blah, blah, blah. And so I don't know if Matt Parrott had written something somewhere else. I didn't see it, but he wrote a comment to that, and I'm going to get into that. But before I do, there were some comments on at the White Network about my show, this Heretics Hour show last week. And they're interesting, and they bring up some things I want to say. So I'm gonna bring those up. And the first one is from Hadding, and he said, "Well, I'll just read what he said. He said women have a great deal of power through the fact that men love them and want to take care of them. A woman can generally expect that somebody will help her if she has difficulties." A man in the same situation is always expected to deal with it himself. So he comes up with women just no. Okay, that's it. Then my answer to this, I have a hard time following my own notes. My answer to this is that women just as much as women love men and want to take care of men, just as much as men love women and want to take care of women. Do men not realize that? I think men just take it for granted. How women really do take care of men. They don't provide maybe for their financial. They don't provide for. They don't bring home the bacon, as it's said. Although they're starting to now. Often they do now, but traditionally they haven't. But they have certainly taken care of men, and because they loved them and. Men can hardly get along without women after they've had a wife for a long enough time. Although the sexes are becoming more, a little bit more independent. But in my experience, I've taken care of men and I've taken good care of men just as, and often it's different, but it's not always the same, but, often than more taken care of than I've been taken care of. So that's my answer to that. Now, Conrad said, also wrote, that Orthodox Christians are definitely not open to queers. Russian, he's a Christian himself, Conrad. And I guess he might be an Orthodox Christian. He says, Russian Orthodox were so upset by the Gay Pride Parade that they had the mayor of Moscow abolish all Gay Pride Parades for the next 100 years. That is the kind of response to homosexuality the Western Christians need to take. He says Western Christians need to stand up. What he means is firmly against homosexuality. Conrad is a real straight-talking person. And so I want to bring up here, as I brought up last week, that Matt Parrott says he is a Christian. He's a Western Christian, but he's a Christian Orthodox now. And so I think Conrad needs to write to Matt and talk to him as a fellow Christian. Maybe Christians need to have a discussion about this, where they stand on this. I wanted to right here bring up something that Lasha Darkmoon wrote in the article that I have already talked about. And here she, this is a quote from it, in San Francisco and other big cities, cocaine is openly sold in gay bathhouses where it leads to suicidal, unprotected sex. And either she or somebody she's quoting from, I'm not sure, says, in my own city, Toronto, promiscuous, unsafe sex is a popular feature of the bathhouses which have been springing up all over the past few years. Some of them are now licensed to sell beer, which they supplement unofficially with poppers and crack cocaine, smoking in your room as additional perks. Well, this is just commentary on the gay lifestyle, the homosexual lifestyle, and the use of drugs to create higher and higher sexual, I don't know what you'd call it, pleasure or ecstasy or excitement. that, you know, once if they take, they talked about cocaine and methamphetamines as being the most, the drugs that do more to stimulate sexual excitement and sexual desire and so on. So the people, the homosexuals like to take this, and other people too who are addicted to pornography and stuff, take some drugs, particularly these two, and then their sex becomes just wild, you know, orgies, and all their inhibitions fall away, and they do, you know, sexual binges and so on. And this is associated with homosexual lifestyle, and it's very unhealthy, and it's also sick. And this is why, one reason why, we shouldn't be accepting homosexuals into our society as being normal, as it being a normal way to be, because there's a lot of that going on. Okay, now Conrad continues saying about Matt Parrott. He says, I liked his humorous comments on the Friday show back when it was on, but he really needs to finally make a decision. He didn't go far enough in condemning James O'Meara's filth. I don't like hating others, but what James O'Meara writes and promotes, and he puts a quote, which I didn't know was there, but rainbow thongs on young boys. He wants to put rainbow thongs on young boys, which came up in his interview with Robert Stark on Voice of Reason, is just as filthy, says Conrad. I think he thinks it's just as filthy as what the Allen Ginsberg used to write. That is why I say Matt Parrott needs to make up his mind. No compromise with queers. They are a worm in our apple. So again, that's clear. And probably do Christians and homosexual... can the Christian and homosexual lifestyle ever come together? So if not, you know, I say once again, and I'm saying this because I kind of care about it, because I know Matt Parrott is not a homosexual, but is, you know, if he's really a Christian, what is he doing? And what is he doing there? Now, men at the White Network, from these comments that I'm going to read, like all white nationalist men, want to bring up feminism as the only problem or the main problem. And Hattie and ATN and Carl said that men should have the jobs, and the women should be fulfilled with her. The woman should be fulfilled with her role in the home as wife and mother. And that's that. You know, that's how it should be. That's comes from patriarchy, and they say that it's natural and that women don't need anything more, because I brought up the subject of money, you see, and earlier, and I brought it up in the show last week too, and I made that very clear what I thought about that. And but they said that that women shouldn't get any money for being mothers and so on, and that they should be happy. They should want to. They have to want to do it, and they must want to do it. to have their role in the home as wife and mother. Now, I said, that's not enough. I brought up, this is what I wrote. I brought up the subject of money in my Monday program. Women give up a lot of money, and even under a moderately patriarchal society, money is power, and those without the money are powerless. Women should be paid by the government to stay home and have children. Men should not be paid for having children if they have the jobs. Now, ATN thought that I was recommending, well, he thinks that I'm recommending feminism with this policy. So he wrote that his idea is not the same as the feminism that Carolyn seems to be recommending, which is equal access of women to the public realm rather than defending the private realm of women and family piety against the public realm. Yeah, it's always the women who should be pious, but the men aren't being pious out in public. But the women should be pious. This is, you know, typical double standard, which seems totally appropriate to men. But he goes on to say the problem with trying to make having children profitable is that the state would find it difficult to fund the equivalent of a full-time woman's wage for every mother up to half the population, albeit not all their lives. So he thinks I'm saying that every woman is going to get this money, maybe even the same amount of money, for being at home and being a mother. So he says, that won't work. So women have to see motherhood as sacred in some sense rather than profitable, or at least there has to be some compromise in that direction, compensated by recognition and public esteem. So, you know, if you give some recognition to mothers and public esteem, that's going to be enough. He misunderstood what I was saying, so I corrected him. And I said the state would not fund every mother. That was never my idea. But only those who can show that they're capable of earning a certain wage in the private or public sphere. These would be the more intelligent and educated women, not the ones that have no valuable skills to begin with. It's just the women who are giving up what they could be earning, what they could be doing. And these are desirable women who have the genetic traits, if we, you know, and we have to think about eugenics, that we want to pass on. We want to be sure to pass these on to our future generations. And so these women are on a different level, just like lots of men are on a different level and rewarded more than other men, because they can do work that the other men can't do that has higher value to it. Well, they're higher value women. And it's not a question that, oh, the only thing that counts with women is what good mothers they are, or how well they can, pop out the babies. But there's also the value of the genetic material. And these women who are intelligent and who are good looking and who are healthy and who can do, valuable knowledge and skills. We want these women to be mothers too. Why not? But a lot of them would be. But you have to give them something, and you can't just give them a badge like you did in the past. I don't think that going back to any of this stuff in the past is the way to do it, to somehow force women to do that. Women have been liberated, and it's a different world, and we have to come up with creative ideas. We are very creative. And I would say that most women want to have children. They want to have families. But the way things are set up now, if they're not set up to help these women do this. And so, the idea would be to, I have that further on, I'm sure, would be to, compensate these women. Now there's some more here. This brought on somebody named Svitjod, who said, Carolyn, in an earlier show you said that you think a country's leadership should be male. Have you changed your mind about that? You know, I get that every so often from these guys who are going to judge me on what I think, if they think I'm a feminist, or they want to find out if I'm a feminist. If I say the wrong thing, then they can accuse me of being a feminist and all this stuff. But you see, this is kind of paranoid, because if any woman in white nationalism shows the slightest sign that she might put women before men, they think that's a good reason to attack her and call her a feminist and so on. Whereas for some reason, women are supposed to put men first, while men put men first, and everybody puts men first. And this is what they consider to be healthy. Now, my answer, though, I could answer him, which I have already said this before, that I think that top political positions, and really even a lot of the appointed positions of that these top president, chancellor, governor, etc., and the people they appoint, or the people who do the running of these public affairs, should be male. He said, you think they should be male? Well, I can certainly answer yes, they should be male. And I believe they should be male. But that's the ideal, see? But they should also be competent in serving their public, not private interests. So our male leaders have done a poor job overall, in some cases disastrous. Just because a person is of the male sex doesn't make him intelligent, competent, moral, decent, honorable, committed to his people, or capable of sustained hard work. Many of these male leaders are lazy and, of course, corrupt. And we can put that across the board, whether it's in the mainstream politics or in white national politics or whatever. All the men, well, I say here, what is to be done? The fact is that there are some women who would do a better job than many men who are currently holding office. But the problem of the quality of women is the same as the problem of the quality of men. So I'm not recommending, I'm not saying, well, women would do a better job. They probably wouldn't do a better job. There'd be the same problems. But men will not hold their fellow males accountable because they want to protect them from, they don't want to criticize the men too much because that might then be a reason to say, well, let the women come in and do something. And so these men, aren't worthy of our respect, because it's up to the men to see that if they want to hold this power, if they want to administer the state, they must do a good job of it. And they're not doing, nobody's doing a good job of it. So what's going on? What is to be done? I'm only saying that there are always some women who would do a good job. But not just to transfer all women to it, but, if the men aren't doing a good job, the thing is that I say is that they're more worried about women getting any kind of equality than they are about finding the best people to lead. And it's up to men to see to it that this is what's done. So the better question to ask would be, what are we to do? What are the men to do, and why aren't the men supervising themselves? Well, because they're a men's club, you see. So this is what has to be looked at, in my opinion. We need to look beyond where we've been looking. We need to look deeper, but this takes risk, and these people don't want to risk anything. They're not even revolutionaries at all. They're conservatives, and they want to hold themselves in leadership positions, even if they're not good at it, even if they don't have that much to offer. And, even if they're not leading us anywhere, that's beside the point. So I find there's a lot to criticize. There's a lot to push aside all this dreck that comes out from these people, and not listen to it, and ask the hard questions and expect somebody to give some answers. Now, I want to go on a little bit more about this idea about who are the most, about these most valuable women being paid for staying home with children, by using an email from Carl, who's a real good supporter of the White Network and of me. But he sent an email, which I didn't approve, but I knew I was going to use it on this program. I didn't have time to reply to it then, and I didn't want it sitting there, attracting comments, since I thought some of its premises were faulty, and I couldn't reply to it. So I said, I'm going to save this for the program. So sorry, Carl, but, Carl wrote, I have long thought that the payment to the, this is just part of what he wrote, because he writes a lot. I have long thought that the payment to the family shall take the form of a reduction in taxes, together with a bonus per child, together with lowered taxes and ways to become competently educated without putting the house in hock. I'm not sure who's going to be competently educated, maybe the children. This adds up to a fair system that will help enormously. Then he asked me, are you thinking more in terms of regular payments to women? See, he wants to pay the family, not the woman. Excuse me. And I said, yes, I am. I'm saying now. Yes, I am thinking in terms of regular payments to women. It is a woman who is giving up her employment and career momentum in a field that is highly or well paid. The man with the job is handed his paycheck, made out to him. It's not made out to the family, right? The man who's out there working for the family, but the paycheck comes to him in his name. And he cashes it, hopefully puts it in the bank account or whatever. But so the woman's paycheck would also be made out to her. That's only right, you know. If we trust the man to use his paycheck for the good of the family, why wouldn't we trust the woman to use hers similarly? She is much more likely not to waste hers on booze and going out with the guys. Not all men do that, but some do. They say, well, I got to take part of this money for my own enjoyment. I worked hard all week. But, you know, not giving any credence to, well, in the, it used to not be at all. Give the women any credit for all the work they did all week at home and with the kids and with all the things they had to do. No, it's only the man who thought he worked, he got paid. She didn't get paid, so therefore she wasn't worth getting paid. And that's part of the problem. That we all these men will say, oh, women are so valuable to us, and they're at home. You know, we need them to raise our children, to be mothers, and all that. We do appreciate that so much. They need to get back to doing that. But what are they doing for? Some women are treated very well. It's right, and they don't have any complaints, and they don't want to change anything. That's not always the case. But it should be that both the man and the woman are under a social obligation in a white racial society to support the family with their income. So they would both be expected to do that. But the fact is that this paycheck from the government goes to the woman because she is the one who has agreed to do this when she could have done something else. See, she could have done something else. And this is for the good of the society. So I think that my idea is right. And now, Carl, he didn't hear me answering this because this is just a part of his original email here. He goes on to say, I think your system, meaning my system, if I have described it adequately, that is to pay the woman, would certainly alter the nature of society. Men would work to support families in general, and women would have a paid career as mothers. So you see, you know, my comment here, even Carl can't picture women quite fairly, that somehow a man gets paid for the work he does, but the woman shouldn't get paid to be a mother. Now, he says it might work, but it might have surprising effects and unintended consequences. I think a safer route would be a one-time payment to the family. Well, I say that, yeah. He wants a one-time payment to the family, not to the woman, and cultural institutions that are not operated for profit. This requires men and women to cooperate according to their nature rather than become societal units first and foremost. Well, you know, this is not real clear to me. He's not being clear enough because he's wanting to skip over things that he doesn't want to talk about. And a lot of this is kind of taken from what National Socialism appeared to be in Germany, but that was a different time, a different place, a different people, and I think that it's wrong to say that okay, it's wrong to say that the money should be a one-time payment because this gives men a paycheck from their employer. But a woman is not trusted with a paycheck from her employer, which is the government that wants more children. So you see how this works? I don't think this would be a problem at all within the family. It's just that men are not used to thinking of women and having in any way any kind of equality. They want to, as Hanning said earlier, they wanted to take care of women. And therefore, women have to be taken care of. They can't... you know, they can't go beyond that, which is kind of a child's role. Now to go on here, I've just got a lot of comments here. I may have already made enough of these comments that I don't need to go through all this. I've already said that women want to have children, but I would say they're not so crazy about having to take care of a man all their lives. This is what men are maybe afraid of, but, you know, because once the children grow up, the woman might say, well, okay, you know, I'm done with this. And then women are a lot better at taking care of themselves as they get older than men are. But, you know, if men treat a woman right, if men are a loving husbands and they work at a good relationship, there's no reason that the woman would want to go away, you know, after the kids grow up a little bit or grow up altogether. So, you know, this just takes a lot more from men than men are used to putting forth. And that's why so many men today, including all these homosexuals, are pushing this idea of a man-based society, manly society, where the men make all the decisions and the men associate with men, and the women are back home in the house as it was in Rome and Greece, you know, and in these, you know, back in time when we still had all these, when we still had to follow what the authorities said. Well, when the modern age had not come and they want to, this is why they call themselves traditionalists. They want to cross out everything that's happened in modern times because they don't like how the role of woman has changed, and they want to go back to something. And I'm saying that this is a waste of time. Why don't we come up with creative solutions to this and to increase our numbers and get with it instead of all this old baloney that these men are pulling up because they can't. They're afraid. They're afraid of what will happen. They know that they have less going for them than they want to pretend that they do. And maybe if they didn't have all these crutches, they would have more going for them. They would do something about it. I'm calling on men to take charge here and get some, you know, shake the dust out of their eyes and break through some of this old thinking and come up and be more creative and come up with solutions for our society, because I don't see anything happening, and that's why people see a hopeless situation in the future. It's because of our own people not facing up to the enemies that we have in what our real enemies are, and making up enemies, you know, in the form of women, white women, who they're constantly talking about and complaining about and blaming for everything that's going on. Can't be. It cannot be. Now I'm going to go on to what Matt Parrott wrote and make some points here about it. He is responding to a comment by Stronza. This is on the Countercurrents website. The title of the article is Battered White Nationalist Syndrome. And in the comments, there's not that many comments, actually. It's kind of the subject is Merlin Miller, the subject of the article, Battered White Nationalist Syndrome, and it's critical of Merlin Miller and what he said. And to Stronza from Matt Parrott, there were some comments, and Stronza wrote something, and then Matt comes in for the first time. You know, he didn't write the article, and he suddenly comes up with in a comment, and he says, perhaps there's some very clever strategy going on here that I don't get, but I don't think so. speaking of Merlin Miller's, who he's speaking of, he says, his statements against us weren't even forced. They were offered offhandedly. Even Ron Paul has the discipline and tact to refrain from bashing us until he's cornered. So let's see here at the end, he says, I'll read this part. He says, have you counted how many movement vehicles have been driven off the cliff of civic nationalism in the name of mainstreaming and popularity? Well, he's saying if we try to mainstream too much in order to get more popular and turn to something called civic nationalism rather than white nationalism and so on, we're going to go the way of all these other organizations that failed to take us where they said they would in the beginning and kind of wimped out and became mainstream. And he says that he won't join anything like that. He won't join in. So he's very critical. Well, then some other people wrote some other things, and they were critical of Matt Parrott, some of them weren't, but they're recommending that we don't divide ourselves at all, that we don't criticize other people in the movement. They brought up how Merlin Miller had done so much good, and the A3P was, you know, had good people like McDonald and Sunik and James Edwards and so on, who somebody said they held up as, you know, top, you know, I don't know, admired so much. And to complain about what Merlin Miller said and to talk like this, that Matt Parrott was finally, you know, trying to be a little more radical. He's not very, but he's trying to be. He's always kind of moved along, where others, well, there's a lot of people there, obviously, who aren't. And they're busy appraising Greg Johnson and countercurrents and so on, but they don't want there to be any kind of division amongst the people. So, Matt Parrott answers, should we be populist or polarizing? He says, I've arrived at the latter after long consideration. He wants to be polarizing, but I believe that we should strive to avoid infighting and backbiting between these two schools of thought. And should the groups turn on one another? He disagrees with attacking implicit white nationalism, but he, on one condition, the implicit white nationalist must not attack us. So he's saying that Merlin Miller attacked white nationalists, and so they should have every right to attack back. Oh, he goes on and on with lots of he says it could become complicated. Well, he kind of complicates it. And to say something flat out, he finally says, it would be unacceptable and unsustainable for those who want to support white identity to be bankrolling a man who's going around explaining why civic nationalism is moral and ethnic nationalism is reprehensible identity politics. That's how Parrott sees it. And then he says, I believe we vanguardists ought to bend over backwards to accommodate and respect these implicit mainstreamers. Now, but we're not going to bend over forwards. Now, Matt Parrott is not a vanguardist. If he thinks he is, it's because he's comparing himself to A3P and Merlin Miller. In the face of Merlin Miller, he's a vanguardist. But he's not a vanguardist. We're vanguardists here at the White Network because, you know, we come right out with what we believe and what we are. And they don't. So, now, this gets a little confusing here. Let's see what else I have done. Okay. He says my way of, he's just arguing with this Andrew guy who doesn't want to criticize anybody. And he's saying why sometimes it's necessary, but it's not very radical. And he says, he just says that there's a desperate desire for any motion at all that constantly tempts us to settle for sideways and even backwards motion because there's a wall stopping us from moving forward. We must tear down that wall. Well, I was amazed at that. There's a wall stopping us. You know, Parrott agrees with Johnson and McDonald on Hitler, National Socialism, World War II, and Holocaust. That's the wall. You know, that's the wall that's stopping us. That's the wall that we've got to tear down. But they don't think that that needs to be torn down. I don't know what wall Parrott thinks he's going to tear down, except talking about white identity as though that's really far out, you know. That's really vanguardist to do that. I don't know anything else that he's saying. He says that, Andrew doesn't like to throw around the words traitor and betrayal when discussing the A3P board because, you know, he admires these three men I mentioned earlier so much. And then Parrott says, well, he didn't use those words against the board, and he has the utmost respect for them and acknowledge that they're in an awkward situation. Why are they in an awkward situation? I guess the only awkward situation is Merlin Miller. So he's their presidential candidate, and they don't want to denounce him. So they're in an awkward situation when he talks like he does. But all that Parrott can say, and all that ends up from this whole thing, is that that this man shouldn't use his political airtime to speak exclusively of concerns. Oh, well, I don't know who's saying that, actually. So, Matt Parrott, my comment is that Matt Parrott is finally standing up to someone in the white movement, but too bad it's just Merlin Miller. I think he should be standing up to a few more people. He wants to talk kind of tough, but his actions and his associations aren't fitting with that. And what is going on there at Countercurrents is pretty tame, and it's mostly just fundraising, you know. And also, some of these commenters are all chiming in and saying, send money to Countercurrents. Send money to Greg Johnson. Send money. Don't send money to anybody that's not doing the right work. Don't send money to A3P. Don't send money to Ron Paul. Don't send money to whoever else. Send money to Countercurrents. What is Countercurrents doing, and what are they going to do with the money? That's what I'd like to know. I really like to know. There's a number of people who have kind of moved over there from Voice of Reason, and now they're championing that place because they don't have any other place. They don't know what else there is. Look here, at the commenters at the Occidental Observer for Lasha Darkmoon's article are really a bunch of rather pathetic comments, I'll tell you. They look bad. Maybe the best people just didn't comment. This article of hers has some interesting things in it. She says that a bizarre added feature found in cocaine addicts, and she did a lot of research on this, seldom mentioned outside specialist publications, is that this is one drug that often manages to turn heterosexual males into homosexuals, even against their natural inclinations and much to their subsequent disgust. Gay porn apparently does the trick, easing the way. I mean, if you look at gay porn along with taking these drugs, particularly cocaine or amphetamines, methamphetamines or meth, which is pretty terrible stuff. You get so turned on, and you then start identifying in your brain with this homosexual sex and homosexual pornography, and it eases you into homosexuality, and then you start thinking that way. That's what this research has shown, and they say that straight females can take cocaine without necessarily becoming lesbians if they're looking at this gay, at this lesbian porn, then maybe she doubts this. She doubts this, or Darkmoon doubts it. Her own experience in observing others convinces her that bisexuality can be induced in both sexes by a combination of drugs and sex. I don't know if that's her words or something she's quoting from now, but I want to say that I already said that the comments are disappointing. You know, this article that she wrote combines pornography with masturbation, saying that if you indulge in this a lot, and the statistics are that tons of white males do so. Tons of white males indulge in pornography. And then there's a lot who look at gay pornography. I suppose the gays look at gay pornography, but if straights look at gay pornography, they're going to be led into... But here's the thing that's supposedly important. They look at this so while they masturbate. You know, this is getting kind of icky, I guess, but they look at this stuff while they're masturbating, and so they do a whole lot of masturbation. And the reason that they keep doing it and it gets worse is because it's addictive. So the pornography is addictive, and you want to keep seeing it, and then you masturbate while you look at it. And women can do it too, obviously. And then you have to go back for more. And then you want harder and harder stuff. And it really is, I do recognize that this kind of sex, there's something deep in human beings that is, that gets excited about stuff like this. And, it doesn't take long. It does not take long to get caught in it where you don't have the ability to stop yourself from going back to it. And so you have these chronic masturbators and porn watchers, and they want to cover it up. They don't admit it. You know, they're in denial, and they don't talk about it. And I think a lot of these, a lot of these comments were all these men trying to poo-poo this and play it down and talk about how, defend masturbation and saying it wasn't like this at all. And, they're blaming it. They even start blaming it onto women. That some of them, that if women were nicer to men, then men wouldn't have to resort to this kind of thing. Really, you know, it's all so childish, and this is supposed to be such a great white national site, the Occidental Observer. And these people commenting are all regular commenters, and it's rather amazing some of the things that they say. So I would say that there is a sex problem. There is a sexual problem. And the majority of white men are in denial about it. And there's a doctor, Donald Hilton, who has a real good article that she linked to. And he has, he and others have proven that pornography is an addictive drug. They call it a drug because it is, it alters the brain, okay? And it does alter the brain depending on how you want to think about brain altering. It alters the thinking, and you can't really go back to your prior way that you were without a whole lot of work, and probably never really, because it's that strong. It's that strong of an altering experience pornography is. Once you get hit with it, and it really excites you, it's difficult to shake it off at all, and you never forget it. You know, you never get over it, even if you stop indulging, if you can, you know, have the discipline to do that. It's always changed you some way. Now here we know that pornography business is Jewish. You know, we know that, you know, thinking about what Hanning Scott and I are reading in the International Jew, and the idea that they have an overall plan on how to weaken the Gentiles and make them susceptible to what they want so that they can take over. It's hard to deny that altogether when you see what's going on and the kind of things that the Jews are so involved in. I don't go for, you know, I'm not satisfied to say, well, they just do that because they can make money at it. There's a lot of money in it, and wherever they can make money, they go. It has nothing to do with any plan to take over the Gentile mind and make it their slave. But it is Jews who are behind all this, and then Jews who want to turn our people into homosexuals too. It's Jews who are behind this whole homosexual movement, and the homosexuals are just people who, men who, some were born that way, but some got turned that way because they've fallen under this kind of influence. And once they do, they want more people to, just like alcoholics want everybody around them to drink with them, want to get even people they love, they want to get you to drink with them. You know, my husband did. You know, they want to get you to drink with them. And they can't help it. And homosexuals want to get other people to be homosexuals, even if they say otherwise. Now, here's a comment from Fender that I copied because I thought it was so interesting. To this article of Lasha Darkmoon's article on the pornography and masturbation, talking about homosexuals in the white nationalist movement. Somebody was talking about that. He said, when Jared Taylor was on Phil Donahue's show, a man called in stating he believed in everything Taylor said, but also that he was worried about Taylor's stance on homosexuality because he himself was gay. Okay, so he's saying, oh, I believe everything you say about whites and everything, but I'm worried because I'm homosexual, whether I'd fit in. And Taylor did the smart thing, according to Fender, and said that the guy isn't alone and that he wouldn't be unwelcome at an Amarin conference. Fender says, I can't help but think that 99% of white nationalists would tell the guy to F off, that homosexuals are ruining white society and all this other stuff. And he finishes with, we need as little division as possible. Well, these are these people who say that any division is wrong. We should let everybody in who's white, no matter what, welcome everybody, and then just see how it works out, I guess. This is an issue that we have to deal with, I think, in among white people. We have to deal with circumcision. We have to deal with homosexuality and what our beliefs are about that and what our position is about that. And we also are going to have to deal with unhealthy sex and pornography and so on. We're going to have to deal with all these things, but these are the things that nobody wants to deal with. They don't want to deal with it. They want to be in denial about all this, and they want to say that anybody who brings it up is just causing problems, is causing dissension, and also we don't want to divide people, so we won't talk about any of this. And that's my consensus of what is wrong with the white nationalist movement, what needs to be done, and what the solutions would be to deal with all of this. So thank you for listening tonight, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be back once again next week on the Heretics Hour. Good night.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.